would like to talk about. So in this first talk, I'm just going to describe the results which appear in my paper with John Wolfson. So that you can download the paper. It's posted at the AIM website, which I have listed there. It's also posted at the archive website, which is written on the blackboard there. So if you'd like to, you can download it. It deals with to describe the results. Let me first say that it deals with a four-dimensional almost Kähler manifold. Although I'm just going to describe the results in the Kähler case in this talk. So if you remember from yesterday, that consists of a Riemannian four manifold together with an almost complex structure and an associated symplectic form, which is the Kähler form defined by G and J. And the first result I want to describe to you, which is very relevant to what we're doing, is we're going to represent two-dimensional integral homology classes by Hamiltonian stationary surfaces. We first need to decide which two-dimensional classes can be represented by Lagrangian surfaces or by Lagrangian cycles. So we can allow singular surfaces if we like. This actually, although I'm sure it's known, is not really the standard result which you would hear in symplectic geometry. So first, I want to claim that that the necessary and sufficient condition for representing a class by a singular Lagrangian cycle is the condition that the class be orthogonal to the symplectic form. Okay, so and let me give a proof of that, because it uses some ideas which are also used in the in the paper later. One ingredient in the proof is the result that if I take a curve in R4, just with its standard symplectic structure, then the curve bounds a Lagrangian disk. Actually, you can make it an immersed Lagrangian disk if you like, if and only if the period integral, the integral of eta, where eta is, for example, the form x dy. It's the primitive of the symplectic form. So this is a necessary condition, as you can see by Stokes' theorem. And the sort of classical result in symplectic geometry is that it's also sufficient. In fact, actually, one thing which we use in our paper is a quantitative version of this. And it was originally proven by Gromov, and the proof was greatly simplified and made very explicit in a very nice paper of Daniel Alcock, which appears in Gotha, I think, in the late 90s. What they did is they proved that under this period condition, you can in fact construct a Lagrangian disk, which whose boundary is the curve gamma, and whose area is controlled. So you can control the area of the disk by the usual isoparametric type quantity, namely a constant times the length of gamma squared. Okay, so that's the first ingredient that we're going to use. Now, the second ingredient is we're just going to use the fact that any integral homology class in a four-manifold can be represented by some smooth embedded surface. Okay, so it's an easy result in topology. So we're just going to choose any smooth representative for that class to begin with. I call that sigma naught. And then the way in which the homological condition is used is we're going to assert, okay, so if we think of taking the form omega and restricting it to sigma naught, then the fact that the integral of omega is zero, omega is a two-form on a surface, the fact that the integral is zero is equivalent to omega being exact on the surface. Okay, so if you have a two-form on a surface, if it integrates to zero, then it's d of a one-form. On the surface. Okay, so in particular, along the surface, we can find a primitive of omega. And then if we take a little tubular neighborhood around sigma naught, we can then, using sort of standard theory for differential forms, the homotopy formula and such, we can extend this eta naught to a one-form eta on the full tubular neighborhood. Okay, so in that tubular neighborhood of sigma naught, the symplectic form is exact. Okay, so that's where the homological condition is used. So we can find a one-form eta, which is defined in the neighborhood of sigma naught, which so that its derivative, its d is omega. Okay, now once we've done that, we can in fact approximate sigma naught uniformly in Hausdorff distance by Lagrangian surfaces. Okay, and so the way we can do that is we can choose a fine triangulation of sigma naught. So we can take our sigma naught and we can just choose a triangulation. We make these sides short. And then if we consider a typical green triangle there, then if I look at a typical edge, the triangle, then because the edge is small and eta is a smooth form, this integral, the integral of eta over the edge, is in fact small. Okay, so what I can do then is I can perturb my green triangle to a red triangle so that the edge integrals on the red triangle, in fact, I can keep the vertices the same, and I can perturb so that the edge integrals on the red triangle are actually zero. So the integral over the perturbed edges are all zero. And you can do that by you can think of the difference between the perturbed edge and the original edge as being bounding a little piece of a symplectic surface. So if you put in a little piece of symplectic surface, then you can, then the integral of omega on that piece is strictly non-zero. So I can do that perturbation to make all of the edge integrals zero for this form eta. Now, once I do that, you see, I have on each of the red triangles, I just have a one skeleton. So I have these red triangles, and now what I can do is use the step one here. So I've now arranged that the integral of eta around each of the one skeletons for each associated triangle is zero. So in fact, even the integral over each edge is zero, as I've arranged it. And then I can use the first property to put in a symplectic, a Lagrangian spanning disk for each of those triangles. Okay, so notice this period condition actually is independent of which primitive you choose. So in this case, we have some locally defined primitive for the symplectic form. Okay, so in that way, I can then fill in each of the red triangles with a Lagrangian disk, and then putting those together, I get a piecewise smooth. It's a Lagrangian approximation to sigma naught. Okay, so you see that the condition that the two-dimensional class be orthogonal to omega is equivalent to the existence of a piecewise smooth, say, Lagrangian surface representing the class. Okay, so once we have a Lagrangian representative, we can then do our business and minimize, right? So once the class is non-empty, we can produce a minimizer in the class. Okay, so in particular, for such a class, we can find a least area Lagrangian sigma in that class. And in fact, actually, we're also restricting the topology here. So we're not minimizing over all integral currents, but we're minimizing, say, among images of maps. So the sigma is really produced as a surface of finite genus in this construction. Okay, we could do it for integral currents, but we haven't done the regularity for that case. So. Okay, so then we can ask the question, well, what's the structure of this sigma? Okay, is sigma a smooth, say, branched immersion? And the answer is clearly no, that it can't be a branched immersion. And why is that? Well, let's go back to yesterday's lecture. Let's do it in terms of mean curvature. If we go back to yesterday's talk, remember that the Ricci 2 form restricted to the surface, the Lagrangian surface sigma, if I had a smooth surface, immersed surface, then the Ricci 2 form is d of the mean curvature form, right? So that's a formula we derived yesterday. So that's true even for immersed surfaces. So for any regular surface, regular Lagrangian surface, that's true. So in particular, it's true that if I integrate the Ricci 2 form over sigma, I have to get zero. Right? So remember that I had this trivialization of the canonical bundle over sigma. But this integral of the Ricci form over sigma is also a homological invariant. Right? So that's, if I divide by 4 pi, that's the first Chern class of sigma. Okay? So in particular, in order that I have a smooth, say, branched immersion, actually the branch points don't really affect this calculation. If I had a smooth branched immersion, Lagrangian immersion in this class, then I would find that C1 is zero on that class. Right? So in particular, if I choose a class, and it's easy to construct such classes in Kähler manifolds, where the symplectic form integrates to zero, but C1 is not zero, then the resulting surface has to have singularities which are worse than branch points. Okay? So that's something which we actually didn't realize until last summer. We should have known it long ago. Okay, so in particular, even these minimizers have to be singular. They have to have some singularities worse than branch points. Okay, so we're looking for singularities in this problem. So the first place, if you have experience in minimal surface theory, you would look for singularities as you would look for cones. Okay, so let me describe the cone singularities quickly in this problem. So a cone, this would be a two-dimensional cone in R4, a tangent cone, if you like, which would be sort of the local picture of the singularity. So that would be described by a curve in S3. So we look for a curve gamma in S3, and we want the cone over gamma, that is just the union of the rays through the origin passing through points of gamma, to be a Hamiltonian stationary cone. Okay? So if you study that problem, you can actually characterize such curves in a very nice way. It's a very pretty geometrical description of those curves. First of all, if we think of the tangent space to the cone along gamma, then that, of course, is spanned by gamma prime, the tangent to gamma, and by the radial vector, because the ray is in the cone. So those actually, gamma prime and gamma, form an orthogonal or an orthonormal basis for the tangent space. And then so that you can see that the condition that the cone is Lagrangian is equivalent to saying that, say, for example, gamma prime is orthogonal to J of gamma. Okay? And this condition is the condition that the curve be Legendrian. It's a Legendrian curve with respect to the standard contact structure on S3 induced as a hypersurface in C2. So the horizontal distribution is just given by taking the position vector, the normal vector, to the sphere and taking J of it. So that gives a tangent vector field. And then the orthogonal complement of that is the horizontal spaces for the contact structure. Okay, so the curve gamma should be a Legendrian curve, and in order to describe the geometric condition on the curve that that the cone be Hamiltonian stationary, it's nice to describe in terms of the Hopf map. So if we think of the Hopf map, I'll call it pi from S3 to S2. So it's just the map which takes a pair of thinking of S3 as the unit sphere in C2, if I take a pair of complex numbers, Z1 and Z2, the sum of whose square lengths is 1, then the Hopf map just takes this pair to Z1 over Z2, where I think of this as a point in the Riemann sphere. So when Z2 is 0, I'm going to the point at infinity in the Riemann sphere. So that's the Hopf map. And the fibers, the pre-image of the points of the Hopf map, actually are great circles in S3. In fact, they're the circles given. If I choose any point in the pre-image, then all of the points e to the I theta times that point are also in the same fiber. Okay? So the Hopf map gives you a fibration by great circles of S3. And in fact, the horizontal spaces are really the orthogonal complements of the fibers of the Hopf map. So in fact, this curve gamma, as thought of in terms of this Hopf map, is what you might call a horizontal curve. So it's a curve which is orthogonal to the Hopf fibers at each point. Okay, now in terms of this picture, it's quite easy to describe the condition that the Hamiltonian stationary equation. Okay, so not surprisingly, the condition that the cone be Hamiltonian stationary is the same as the condition that the curve gamma be stationary for arc length, but for horizontal curves. Okay, so consider the arc length function on horizontal curves, then its critical points will produce cones which are Hamiltonian stationary. Okay. And that condition, the condition that gamma be a critical point, is easily described in terms of the Hopf image. So it turns out that this variational problem on S3, if you push it down under the Hopf map, is just the isoparametric problem on S2. Okay. So the curves which are Hamiltonian stationary the curves which are so that the cone is Hamiltonian stationary are precisely the curves whose projection is a circle in S2. Okay. So you're looking for curves in S3 which project to circles in S2, you're looking for, of course, closed curves which have that property. And in fact, you can describe those in terms of rational circles on S2. So if you think of a circle on the 2-sphere, I've drawn it in red there. That's pi of gamma. Then the condition that it be the projection of a closed curve, Legendrian curve from S3, is exactly the condition that if I look at the two areas, A1 and A2, which are determined on S2, their ratio is a rational number. And so what happens is if you take any circle, you can lift at a point, and then you can follow around. Now, typically what will happen is when you come back, it doesn't close up. Right? The rationality condition guarantees that if you go around enough times, it will close up. Okay, so that's a geometric description of these of these curves. Any such circle will be covered by a closed curve of that type. It may be a very long curve. You may have to go around lots of times to close up, but there will be one. So in particular, there's a dense set of circles on S2 which are covered by, which arise in that way, these rational circles. Okay, so there are lots and lots of these closed curves on S3. So each of those gives a singularity for the Hamiltonian stationary problem. And in fact, we can also write these down using a formula. So I've written a formula here. Actually, originally I had the wrong formula, but I think there should be a P there and a Q there for these curves. So these curves are parameterized by pairs of positive integers, which are relatively prime. I mean, you can also, of course, go around the curve several times. If you have non-relatively prime integers, you'll just get a multiply covered curve. And then I've written the formula there. So the curves really all look like that up to unitary transformation in S3. I've parameterized them there on 0 to 2 pi. The reason I wrote the formula is because there's an important invariant attached to these singularities, which is called the Maslov class, or it's a special case of the Maslov class, really. And so what happens for these cones is that if you consider, let's say, in terms of mean curvature, if you consider the mean curvature of the cone, then, of course, the mean curvature will be homogeneous of degree minus 1, as it always is for a cone, of course, unless it's 0, which it's not 0 in these cases. So it's homogeneous of degree minus 1. So its Hamiltonian will be homogeneous of degree 0. Okay. Now, that Hamiltonian actually is a multiple of theta. And so in particular, the mean curvature, the Hamiltonian for the mean curvature has a period around the origin for these cones. And that period plays an important role. So in fact, the primitive beta for the mean curvature is actually P minus Q times theta, as I have written. So in particular, the period, this Maslov index, is P minus Q times 2 pi. So it's a multiple of 2 pi. So these cones have an associated index at the origin, which is the singular point. Okay, so these are potential singularities in the problem. And then of course, what's important for us, since we're performing minimization, is whether or not the cones are minimizing. Okay, and this is a question we looked at actually quite a few years ago now, originally. And there's a sort of relatively easy theorem to prove. You have to look carefully at it. But let me point out that minimizing means that, of course, they won't be minimizing among all competitors, but minimizing here means they're minimizing among Lagrangian disks. Okay, so you're allowed to put in comparison surfaces which are Lagrangian disks. Actually, if we had done the integral current problem, then the minimizing condition would be among all orientable Lagrangian comparison surfaces. Okay? So if you ask that question, are they minimizing, then it's pretty easy to show. It's done in the paper. Actually, we had done it several years ago, that if you take the cones for which the Maslov index is bigger than 1 in absolute value, then those are actually unstable. the cones are unstable. In other words, okay, and precisely, you can find a Hamiltonian function which is smooth with compact support. You can make it zero near the origin, so you don't change anything near the origin. And when you do the Hamiltonian deformation of the cone, you decrease the area up to second order. Right? So you can just do a deformation, Hamiltonian deformation of the cone, which shrinks, which decreases area. So in particular, these cones are not minimizing, the ones with Maslow index bigger than 1. And basically, that's done just by separation of variables. Okay, so it's a stability issue. So you look at the second variation of area, which you have to write down, and then you just consider variations which are in separated form, a function of r times sine or cosine of m times theta, and then it comes down to studying the second variation. It's a little bit complicated because the second variation is a fourth order operator. There are some interesting features in the analysis, but it's basically elementary. One feature that I found interesting in the analysis is that if you do a stability analysis with a second order operator, like for standard minimal surfaces, then the instability, if there is one, always occurs in the lowest modes. So that is when m is as small as possible. And the high modes are always stable. So that when m is big, they're always stable. For this operator, actually, it's interesting that you typically get stable low modes and stable high modes, but there are some intermediate modes which are unstable. So when p and q are sort of big, the unstable modes occur roughly at on the order of square root of pq. So there's some. It's sort of interesting, but it's as I say, it's completely elementary. Elementary to do. And the similar analysis, actually, once we did it correctly, actually a couple of years ago, we thought we could also show that the P minus Q equals 1 cones were unstable. But it turns out that the same analysis done correctly shows that, in fact, they are stable for such variations. So all of the P minus Q equals 1 cones are stable for variations of this type. I come to that in a minute. So let me point out that these singularities. As I've said, we expect singularities which are worse than branch points to occur in our minimizing surface. And if you remember the formal argument for proving minimality that I discussed last time, it involved doing mean curvature flow. Right, or mean curvature deformation. Now, if you try to do that when you have one of these cone singularities, you run into the following problem. Okay, so of course the mean curvature is infinite at the singular point, but you know if you're an analyst, what you do is cut out a neighborhood of the singular point and do it away from the point, right? And try to argue that the stuff near the singular point didn't matter. So if you do that, you cut out a little ball around the origin, then you do the mean curvature deformation away from the origin. I've just drawn a picture there. Then you get a nice area decrease for this perturbed surface. So the red surface is indeed a lot smaller in area than the other surface. Okay. However, what happens is the price you pay for the fact that the primitive of the mean curvature form was not single valued near the origin is that the interior curve here. So you need to fill in that curve, the curve gamma. You get that curve gamma actually has a period integral. So that curve gamma doesn't bound a Lagrangian disk. That's the problem. So for such a surface, mean curvature deformation will not preserve Lagrangian, or it's hard to define so that it would. Yeah.
What you were trying to do with mean curvature deformation ultimately is to prove
minimality.
It's minimal.
Right.
So didn't that require that it was Lagrangian stationary, not just Hamiltonian stationary anyway?
Right. Well, the ones we produce actually minimize, for example, in a Lagrangian homotopy or homology class. So they are Lagrangian stationary.
They are Lagrangian stationary.
Yeah, we're minimizing over a very big class.
So because the difference between Lagrangian stationary and Hamiltonian stationary is some finite dimensional set of test functions.
Right.
And those are basically non-zero elements of some homology. So I was thinking that maybe if you go around that singular point of the origin, you get some element of that homology, that that's the problem, rather than...
First of all, we don't really know how to we don't really know how to minimize where we sort of fix these periods, you know. So you'd like to say, okay, if you minimize in the right class, maybe these Maslow, these periods don't occur in the minimizing surface. But we don't know how to do that. I mean, it's hard to do. But so this is a worse problem than just having a period around a non-trivial curve on the surface.
So this is
local. This is a purely local
issue. Your construction does produce Lagrangian stationary things.
Yeah, it produces Lagrangian stationary things.
Yeah, it's just that most of your techniques only exploit the Hamiltonian stationary consequence of Lagrangian stationary. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say that. No, I mean, we use the techniques use various comparison arguments and things like that. It doesn't work. We don't produce minimizers in a Hamiltonian isotopy class, for example.
Yes.
I mean, we do have to use
right. So they are Lagrangian.
Yeah, they're Lagrangian stationary. Yeah. Right. So there's a problem doing the mean curvature deformation for when you have such singularities. Okay, so on the other hand, okay, so I'm going to describe a little bit about the technical details of this theorem in the second talk today. But so there's a theorem. So what we can prove is that the minimizing surfaces we construct in these homology classes have singularities which are finite in number. So there are a finite number of such singularities, and they're either branch points or they're these singularities I've described. So they look locally like these non-flat. We call them non-flat singular points. Okay, so this minimizing surface is a smooth immersion away from a finite set of points. I've called them P's and Q's. There shouldn't be the same number of each, of course. So that should be. Oh, that is a K. Okay, P1 up to PK and Q1 up to QL. Sorry, I can't read my own handwriting. Right. So the PJs are branch points. So we, of course, expect such singular points just based on the theory of holomorphic disks or classical minimal surface theory. And the Qs are these non-flat singular points. Okay. And so each of the QJs has at least one tangent cone, for which this Maslov index, I've denoted it by end of QJ, it's an integer, and it's non-zero. So the fact that the surface minimizes implies that each of these indices is plus or minus one. Okay? And the there's a formula that says that, in fact, if you sum the indices of the QJs, you get one half C1, and I think I have the one half on the wrong side in this formula. So I think there's a half here. And that should be a 1. So in particular, a corollary of this is that if we took a class where C1 is non-zero, then the sum on the left-hand side has to be non-zero. So in particular, there's at least one of these singular points, so at least one of the cones is in fact not only stable, it's minimizing. It's minimizing among disk-type comparisons. Now, one thing... I mean, there's an unsolved question here, namely, which one, or do all of them minimize? So we actually don't have any direct way to show that which of these cones actually minimizes. So it's one of these very explicit questions about surfaces. So you can, in minimal surface theory is full of questions, like for explicit surfaces, do they minimize or don't they? That can be quite a hard question, even though the surface you know very explicitly. So this is a question like that. We have only this indirect proof that at least one of these cones does minimize. Okay, so let me indicate a proof of this index count. In the Kähler case, you can do it just based on the sort of calculations I did yesterday in the talk, if you remember what they were. So let me suppose, say, that I just have two of these Qs. Okay, so you have to believe me that the branch points don't matter. So you have to do a little bit of asymptotic analysis there. So let's suppose I just have two of the Qs and I don't have any other singularities. Okay, so... So then I can do that calculation, which we did yesterday, away from the two points, Q1, Q2. And away from there, I have this property that D of the mean curvature form is rho, the restriction of the Ricci form to sigma. Okay, so then when I compute C1 of the sigma, I can integrate over the surface, which represents the class. I divide by 4 pi, and I get C1. Now, on the other hand, rho is a nice smooth form, so the behavior, so what happens near those points doesn't affect this integral. I mean, it affects it barely at all. So if I cut out little epsilon disks about each of the q's, q1 and q2, then I don't change this integral much because rho is just a smooth ambient form. And what's near those points has very small area, so there's almost nothing there. So in particular, I can approximate C1 by the integral over the complement of these little balls. And then I can use, on that complement, I can just use Stokes' theorem. D sigma H is rho. And then when I do that, writing down Stokes' theorem here, I get, so the minus sign is just for taking the standard orientations of the boundaries. Then I get the sum of the sum of the integrals of sigma H over those little neighborhoods. Now, on the other hand, for epsilon very small, the boundary of that neighborhood looks like the cone. Okay, so that'll look like a little circle on the cone near the origin. And remember, for the cone, sigma H is just d beta, right? Where beta was p minus q times theta. So this integral will be actually, I have a minus there for some reason. I'm not sure I have the signs right, but it's plus or minus 2 pi times the index of qj. Okay. Right. So what I'm getting there is just the period of beta when I do that integral. Okay, and so if you let epsilon go to zero, you produce this formula. And I think my half... Yeah, so the half is on the index term, right? So that's the... So in the Kähler case, you can prove the index formula from that calculation. It also holds in the almost Kähler case. Okay, so in general, you will have these singular points which occur in solutions. Okay, so we're back to the same question that we started with, namely, can we find minimal Lagrangian surfaces representing homology classes in KE manifolds? Okay, so what happens in the KE case? Well, of course, in the KE case, because C1 is a constant times omega, or rho is a constant times omega, C1 is just a constant times the integral of omega over the surface, so it's zero. Okay, so in the KE case, this total count, index count, is zero. So the total sum is zero. So what that means is that there are an even number of singular points, and they pair up. So there's a plus one for every minus one that occurs. Okay? It doesn't imply that they're not there, unfortunately. That's what we'd like to say. And actually, we looked at this question, and we were able to construct an example of a Hamiltonian stationary. It's probably maybe even Lagrangian stationary, I'm not sure. It's a torus in a K3, a particular K3 surface, which is not minimal. In fact, it's probably zero in homology, even. And in particular, it must necessarily have singular points. So for stationary points, it can happen that that you get these singular points occurring. Actually, this is an example where the torus minimizes with symmetry. So it's a particularly symmetric K3, which has a symmetry group, which is Z2 direct sum Z2, Z mod 2Z direct sum Z mod 2Z. And the torus minimizes among symmetric deformations. It doesn't minimize among all deformations. Okay, so we have an argument, and in fact, if the lecture weren't being taped, I might actually claim this, but since we made a mistake on this before, and I have no reason to overstate it, let me just say that we expect that the QJs will not occur actually the argument we have really uses also the fact that the beta has integral periods, so integral multiples of 2 pi. So at least in that case, so that occurs whenever sigma is an S2, or in, for example, in the Kalabi-Yau case, that should occur. So we expect that, in fact, for minimizing surfaces, these pairs of singularities don't occur, and that you can do better by there's a way to reduce the area by sort of moving the singular points toward canceling out pluses and minuses. And let me just say that I stated this for the compact case, that is where we're dealing with a homology class, or actually the paper is written for homotopy classes of surfaces. But there's a similar discussion you can make for the boundary value problems that I described last time. Right? So I described the free boundary problems which lead to, at least formally, to special Lagrangian or minimal Lagrangian surfaces. So there's a similar discussion which I won't go through for that case. Okay, so in the final part of this talk, I want to just give a little bit more on the variational theory, but let me just also make a side remark that actually if you enlarge the class of competitors and allow competing surfaces in the problem, which are non-orientable, so they're Lagrangian surfaces, but you allow non-orientable surfaces, then in fact it's relatively easy to show that the cones don't minimize. Okay? So if you're willing to put in Mobius bands, you can actually reduce the area, the cone. So in fact that motivates the problem of looking at the this question for Z2 homology. In fact, I'll discuss that a bit more in the next talk if I have time. Okay, so let me say a little more on the setting for the variational problem. So actually, in order to get results on this variational problem, we really sort of replace this problem, the Lagrangian problem, by a slightly different problem, namely what I'll call the horizontal plateau problem in R2n plus 1. So let's just think of the flat case, R2n. And then we can, there's a natural contact space associated with R2n, which is gotten in the following way. So this is a model for the Heisenberg group. It itself is a group, a nilpotent Lie group, and the structure is invariant under the group action. So the key things that we need are we have R2n plus 1. I'll call the coordinates there x, y, and phi. So x and y are just the base coordinates, and I'm adding a 2n plus first coordinate. And there's a contact form theta, which is defined on R2n plus 1, and I'm taking it to be d phi minus this primitive of the symplectic form. Okay, so that's, I'll call that theta. And theta then is a contact form. So the spaces that, so at each point you have the space where theta is zero. That gives us a distribution, codimension one distribution. So those are again the horizontal spaces. So this map pi has structure very similar to the Hopf map that we described before. It's again a situation where I have these contact planes, which are perpendicular to the fibers of this projection map pi. So pi is just the standard projection. It takes xy phi to xy. And then we need to choose a metric. So we're going to consider the horizontal plateau problem. So we need to choose a metric on the horizontal planes. And the way we do that is because we're really interested in things downstairs, we do that just by lifting the metric from downstairs. So in other words, we require that the differential of pi be an isometry on each horizontal space. Okay, and so just thinking of that as a quadratic form, the metric upstairs is the degenerate metric dx squared plus dy squared. Okay. So it's just the lifted metric. But we only really think of this as being a metric on the horizontal planes. Right? We don't care what it does in other directions. Okay, so this has the property that it makes the differential and isometry from the horizontal spaces to the base. And of course, the Hopf map also has that property, I might add, so if you normalize your metrics correctly on the spheres. Okay, so then actually there's a whole host of plateau problems for these horizontal problems. And they're all very interesting, but we only know how to do, do certain cases. So let's see. So in general, if you take K-dimensional horizontal submanifolds of R2n plus 1, what does that mean? Well, you look at submanifolds and you require that the tangent space at each point be contained in this horizontal distribution. Okay, so when K is n, actually it turns out the maximum dimension for which there are any submanifolds like that is n, dimension n. So the maximal dimensional case is called the Legendrian case. So when K is n, These are called Legendrian submanifolds. So just like the curves in S3 were Legendrian curves, that's the case when n is 1. Okay, so in general, you have these Legendrian submanifolds, and then these are Legendrian, and in general, if I take a horizontal sigma, and then when I project it downstairs, I'll get a submanifold which is called isotropic. So it's isotropic for the symplectic form. So the symplectic form will vanish downstairs. Why is that? Well, the reason is because this form theta vanishes upstairs, right? So theta is d phi minus this primitive of the symplectic form. So in particular, when I project downstairs, theta will still vanish. So when I take d theta, I just get omega, right? So omega will be zero downstairs. It's just because d commutes with maps, commutes with differentials of maps. Okay, so I get this large class of isotropic or Lagrangian surfaces, which are the pushdowns, the images of horizontal surfaces upstairs. Now, I actually don't get all Lagrangian surfaces that way. The condition which you need to produce a Lagrangian surface in that way is that it be exact, or an isotropic surface. So exactness just means that if I take this, so when I look at the this form eta, and I restrict it to the surface sigma 1 that I have, so this is a closed form because d of eta is omega, which is 0, right? It's always a closed form, so it defines a Durham cohomology class. The requirement is that this eta be exact, be d of a function. Eta is a 1 form. Okay, and this function phi then becomes the 2n plus first coordinate function on the lift. Okay, so the isotropic surfaces that are produced in this way are the exact ones, the ones that are exact downstairs. So it's really up in this Legendrian setting that the area theory works well. For each k less than or equal to n, there's a plateau problem, the k-dimensional horizontal plateau problem, and you can then pose the variational problem. You can say specify a boundary and attempt to minimize the volume among horizontal submanifolds. Now, if we do it for k equals 1, I just have the solution can be determined explicitly for k equals 1, and it's easy to describe. So if I say take 2 points upstairs and I want to find the shortest horizontal curve connecting the 2 points, how do I do that? Well, it's really equivalent to an isoperimetric problem, just as for S3 going to S2. So the way that works is if you, and it's really an exercise to see this, if you look at the projected points, so x0, y0, and x1, y1, then if I can put in, say, the straight line joining those 2 points, let me call that L. So in general, there won't be a horizontal curve which projects to L, okay? But I can put in that line L. And then if I look at any horizontal curve upstairs joining those 2 points, and I can always find lots of them. In fact, you can see it from this construction. If I look at the projection of that horizontal curve, then I can think of the closed curve, pi of gamma followed by L. Now, the difference in the height, that is phi 1 minus phi 0, which is negative as I have it drawn there, is actually the area enclosed by that curve. So, well, the area in the sense of the integral of this area form. Okay, so you can see that because remember that d phi was eta upstairs, right? And so when I compute the difference in the phis, I'm just integrating eta along that curve. Now, it's easy to see that eta is actually 0 along the line. So I can think of that as an integral over a closed curve, if I like. And so what I have is a kind of constrained minimization problem downstairs. So the length upstairs is the same as the length downstairs. I have a constrained minimization problem where I look at curves for which this area integral is fixed. It's a given quantity. And then I can minimize. Okay? And it's an easy exercise to see that the optimal thing to do is to choose pi of gamma to be a circular arc in the complex line that contains L. Okay, so this line L is a real line. It's contained in a unique complex line, right? So that's a two-dimensional plane. If I choose pi of gamma to be a circular arc in that plane, where the enclosed area is correct, chosen correctly in the plane, then in fact that's the best you can do. So that's the solution. So in particular, the curve upstairs is really a helix. It's a horizontal lift of a circular arc downstairs in that complex plane. Okay, so at least the one-dimensional problem has a very simple solution. So perhaps the higher-dimensional problem is also simple. Maybe it is, but it doesn't seem to be quite as simple as the one-dimensional problem. So let me just say some general things, and then I'll give a little more detail in the next talk. So what's the reason for working in R2n plus 1? Well, the key reason, really, and I don't know if I'll be able to say enough to really explain this in detail, but the key reason is that the symmetry group upstairs is much bigger than the symmetry group downstairs. So downstairs, remember, we had the symplectic transformations, right? So we could do symplectic Hamiltonian deformations, if you like. Well, upstairs, we can do contact transformations. So those are transformations which preserve... Well, they don't have to preserve theta, but they only have the property that they preserve the horizontal spaces. So if you have a diffeomorphism upstairs and you pull back theta, it's only required that the result be a function times theta. Okay? So that the horizontal space at one point is taken to the horizontal space at the image point. Those are called contact transformations. They're also generated by Hamiltonian functions, but the Hamiltonians depend now on an extra variable, the phi variable. And that's very important for doing the theory because you see the Hamiltonian deformations downstairs are all, for example, volume preserving. So you can't do something like do a compression, right, or a dilation, right? And if you know minimal surface theory, you know that dilations play a really key role in the theory. So if you do contact transformations upstairs, then you certainly have dilations. You have a lot of other very interesting transformations which are not Hamiltonian. Okay, so you get dilations if you just take H equals phi, actually, in this theory. I haven't written down the formula for contact transformations, but I won't do that here. Okay, so... So one of the key things is that there is some version of a monotonicity formula, which I'll describe in the next lecture. So really, the case we did actually is the case k equals 2, n equals 2 in this problem. And I have a student named Weiyang Xu who generalized this to k equals 2, n greater than or equal to 3. So he developed a similar theory for isotropic surfaces in the 2n plus 1 dimensional 2n plus 1 dimensional Heisenberg group, the horizontal plateau problem. So he proved a similar result in the sense that he proved the same type of regularity. In fact, the singularities which arise in this in the isotropic case actually are the same singularities as in the Lagrangian case. It turns out the singularities actually live in a four-dimensional space in this case, and I was actually hoping that they may not be minimizing if you enlarge the isotropic case. That turns out to be wrong also. It seems that they actually do minimize in this isotropic case as well. Let's break for 10 minutes, and then in the next talk I'll describe a little more about the some of the aspects of the proof.